Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 220, recorded Monday, October 12th, 2015. Mikko Hipponen. Triangulation is brought to you by NatureBox. NatureBox ships tasty snacks right to your door with over 100 flavors to choose from, like Asiago and cheddar cheese crisps. You'll never get bored with snacking again. Go online to get your first box at naturebox.com/twit. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. And by PillPack, a full-service pharmacy that combines personalized service, convenient packaging, and modern technology to make your life easier. Visit pillpack.com/twit to save $20 on vitamins and OTCs when you transfer your prescriptions. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we talk to some of the most interesting people in technology. We get to sit down with them for an hour and get your questions from the chat room. And I always look forward to this, especially today, because I've actually, from a distance, been a fan of Mikko Hipponen for, it's more than like 25 years. You may know his name. He's a computer security expert, a columnist, and chief research officer for F-Secure. Mikko, thank you so much for joining us today on Triangulation.
Thank you, Leo.
It's great to see you. You know, and the reason I've known you for so long, or known of you for so long, is we were doing a radio show, I think in 1991 or 92, John C. Dvorak and I, and the Melissa, or Mailissa virus was spreading. This was a virus that was spread by floppy disk and email. Actually, it was the first virus to be spread by email, and so it was spreading.
That's one of the first email worms ever, yeah.
Yeah, spreading like a wildfire. And we helped people by sending them free copies of F-Disk. It was a DOS-based antivirus, one of the first.
That's right. Long, long, long time ago.
And still one of the best out there. So welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for 25 years fighting the good fight against malware.
Actually, I'll be here at F-Secure 25 years in June next year because I joined in 1991. So, yeah, very soon, quarter of a century at the same place. So
we've seen a lot of changes in that time. I mean, even Mailissa was a huge kind of wake-up call because it spread so fast. Up to then, virus has been spread on floppy disks.
That's right.
Of all things. What got you into security?
Well, I was originally just a coder. When I joined this company, they didn't actually originally hire me to be researching viruses or doing reverse engineering or hunting hackers. I joined as a database developer doing just coding. But the company started expanding into new fields, including this brand new field of computer viruses. And I had a background of assembly programming and reverse engineering from my Commodore 64 days when I was 16 or 17.
Nice.
So when we needed to reverse engineer malware on MS-DOS-based systems, it was fairly natural to give the samples to me. And that's in 1991. I'm not 25 years later. I'm still doing it.
So you would have to look at the malware, disassemble it, and figure out what it was doing.
Sure. And in the early days, we had so little resources that we didn't, for example, have a spare computer to infect because they were expensive. So what I would do is that I would take these early COM programs from MS-DOS era, and I would actually open it up in debug and print out the whole code and on paper and have a stack of paper and a reference guide for the interrupt list of MS-DOS and go through the code on pen and paper and reverse engineer it manually, which nowadays thinking is just stupid, but, you know, that's the way we do.
You know what? I've done that. It's fun, isn't it? It's like detective work.
It is, but it's changed quite a bit. I mean, when our guys today here in our labs, when they look at complicated 64-bit, you know, Windows drivers, part of some rootkit for a modern modern exploit kit or something like that. It's a quite different ballgame. And it's basically the same thing we were doing 25 years ago, but the level of complexity has gone through the roof.
Actually, I have to correct myself because I'm thinking now, the virus that we were fighting in 91 on Dvorak on computers was Michelangelo.
There we go. That makes more sense because Melissa is probably, because if it's over email, so it's got to be 98, 99.
Much later.
Like that.
Yeah, much later. No. Michelangelo, that did spread from the from a floppy disk, from the boot sector
on
a floppy disk.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sending out, I remember I was making floppies with F disk and sending them out to fans. There you go. Look at it. you've kept those. Is that a library of viruses?
Yep. We probably have Michelangelo stoned.
Stoned.
Or something like,
remember that one. Yep.
Mm-hmm. We probably have Michelangelo somewhere in here. Hey, could it be? Here we go. Michelangelo.
Look at that. So, not even what? On a diskette, on a floppy. Wow.
On a floppy. Yep. The only one missing from this early collection is the first one, which is brain.a. So, of course,
we
used to have that as well, but I don't have it anymore because I took a trip to Pakistan to the original authors of brain.a, and I left my copy of Brain to them.
No kidding. They had lost it?
I don't know. I think they had maybe.
Did you autograph it, Mika?
I you know, when the first PC virus turned 25 years old, we had a discussion about, like, should we do something about that? And I had this stupid idea of going and trying to find the guys who did it 25 years ago. And I actually went back to where it came from, which was the city of Lahore in northern Pakistan. And I found the guys, and we had a nice chat about it. And I did leave my copy of brain.a with them.
No kidding. So, okay, this is mind-boggling. So it's 25 years later. Presumably, they've grown up. They're no longer malware authors, right?
Obviously not. They never wrote any other malware except brain.a, which turned out to be the very first PC malware ever. Now, be careful. We did have malware before PC malware. For example, Apple II malware existed like a year or two earlier. But, of course, PC malware is what really started the real big problems, and we are still fighting PC malware today. And during these years, these guys, it's actually brothers.
The Alfie brothers, yeah.
Yes, Basit and Amjad. Those are the guys I met. And what they're doing nowadays is that they are businessmen. They actually run a telco operator which provides fast fiber optic cable connections throughout the city of Lahore. And the name of their company, which they are running today, is called Brain Telecommunications.
Love it. Love it. That was 1986. Yeah, so... Mm-hmm. So the PC came out in 1981. The Mac came out in 1984. Apple IIs have been out since the late 70s. So, and of course, the first virus anybody knew about was the Morris worm, which goes back even farther.
No, actually, Morris was the first internet worm. That's 1988, so 2 years after
Brain.
So
Brain predated it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize that. I guess I got my chronology confused. I always thought Morris was the beginning of the end in the malware world, but I guess it was not.
Do you know what the author of Morris Worm is doing nowadays?
No, I know his father was a very famous computer scientist. Is he still a computer scientist?
He actually is one of the guys behind Y Combinator.
No.
Works with Paul Graham. Mm-hmm.
Holy cow.
That's right.
That just points out that in fact, I think of Woz and Jobs, who made Blue Boxes, that it's not at all unusual for people who are now stalwarts in the technology industry to have kind of dabbled on the dark side when they were kids. It seems like to be a logical thing.
Right.
Not unusual.
And of course, I think he got some sort of sentence out of writing the Morris Worm, which of course he completed, and he's become a very successful businessman since. But if you actually go to Y Combinator and look at the members of the leadership team and look at the bios, Robert Morris lists in his history something like that. His innovation regarding buffer overflows in 1988 changed the way we think about computer security or something like that.
That's
very well, very nicely put. Not really writing down there that I wrote the first internet word.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, there's some thought that maybe he wasn't trying to make a worm. He just was kind of playing around with the idea, and it kind of he lost control of it, right?
Yeah, yeah. He was using a buffer overflow in the finger D diamond.
Finger diamond.
and it just got loose. A interesting detail about Morris worm, though, is that it never infected our systems here in Finland. And the reason why it never infected our systems is that in 1988, we weren't connected to the internet yet.
What? That's amazing.
We got our connections 2 months later.
No kidding. How interesting. Yeah,
we had a UUCP connection to Sweden, but we didn't have live TCP/IP connectivity, so we were safe.
You had Newsnet, but you didn't have the World Wide Web.
That's right.
Actually, I guess nobody had the World Wide Web in 1988. It wasn't developed.
No.
Yeah.
That was a couple of years later.
Yeah. So, in fact, it's interesting that F-Secure was started so early because was it Brain that inspired F-Secure?
No. I mean, the company was actually started by two guys in 1988 while they were students in a local technical university. And they just started up a company for a place to build whatever consulting work they were doing while they were studying. One of those guys ended up becoming and is today the chairman of board of Nokia.
No kidding.
Mr. Risto Siilasmaa, who's actually still our chairman as well. So the company and you know, the dreams of the guys who started the company in 1988 have continued to grow all the way today. And I mean, I watched this company grow from a six-guy startup to where we are today. We have 1,000 people in 23 countries.
What's the chief business? It's not making antivirus software anymore.
It is actually. We produce security in various ways. So we are still very much a security company. The company is called F-Secure. So it's very much what we do. Although around 60% of our revenues is coming from operator business. So where we provide security as a service through operators around the world, which in a way makes us fairly invisible. I mean, we have millions and millions of users who run our security software on their computers or on their phones every single day and who have probably never heard of us.
Interesting. Was FDisk the first antivirus that came out of F-Secure?
Well, FDisk, let me just get this clear. FDisk was actually a tool from within MS-DOS. FDisk was the tool you used to repartition your hard drive. Then there was a tool called F-Disk.
F-Disk is what I was thinking of.
And that's the tool which you could use to rewrite the MBR and FBR on floppies.
Right.
And that tool was actually part of the cooperation which we were doing at the time with another company which was based in Reykjavik, which is in Iceland. So we're in Finland and they were in Iceland. And that was one of the tools that was, you know, probably, yeah, that's the tool which would kill Michelangelo, yeah.
Yeah. We were sending it out on floppy. I think CDs by then. Spending a lot of time. We sent out over 1,000 floppies to our listeners to fix it. And because at the time F-Disk was free, we could send that along. And now, did it work? So it was just to rewrite the boot sector. It wasn't. It wasn't a virus scanner yet.
No, and it wouldn't actually matter which boot sector virus you had. It would just recreate a clean boot sector for your floppy or for your hard drive. So a very simple tool, but very effective at the time because in MS-DOS 3 and 4, you didn't have a tool to rewrite the MBR. It only came...
Right.
You know, Microsoft included FDisk.
Later, FDisk/MBR came along, but that was not then.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're dating ourselves.
I feel like an old man. You're a young guy. It's so funny because I feel like, gosh, this is ancient history, and yet it isn't in ways either. But we've certainly things have come a long way since. Although I find it interesting that the Robert Tappan Morris worm, used a buffer overflow exploit because that's still the number one way malware works, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, they use vulnerabilities, not really buffer overflows as such because of the systems or the mitigations we have in modern versions of Windows and OS X and other operating systems. But vulnerabilities of various kinds, nevertheless, that's definitely the number one way of getting infected. So the most common way today for getting hit by malware is by surfing the web. So you surf the web, you end up on a website which has an exploit kit waiting for you. So it's been hacked previously. The site might look fine, but there's a script, JavaScript script, which goes through your browser and through your operating system trying to find an out-of-date component like old Flash, old Java, old QuickTime, old browser, or out-of-date operating system. And then they will launch an exploit against the old version of whatever you happen to have on your computer.
Right.
I mean, that's how you most typically get infected.
Yeah. It's funny because we still hear a lot of people saying, oh, I need an antivirus on my computer. And Google just did a really interesting survey of normal people and security experts. Normal people still say number one thing to do, get an antivirus. And the list of things to do by security experts is very low. Update your computer, of course, is number one to avoid these exploits.
It's not number one for me, though.
What is number one for you?
Back up your stuff.
That's the first thing to do. Yeah, because then, but that doesn't stop an exploit. It just means that you've got a backup in case something bad happens.
So then you can recover.
Right. Boy, I wish I had a Carbonite ad right now. I've been saying this for 10 years. Backup your stuff is the best solution to so many issues that happen with technology.
And Carbonite is a great example because I always emphasize that when you back up your stuff, not just your computer, but also your phone, also your tablet,
right,
and back it up so that you can recover it even if your house burns down.
Right. Off-site. Off-site. We're talking to Mikko Hipponen. He is, of course, one of the leading security experts in the world and has been for almost 25 years now. It's a name that is almost, you know, I thought you must be a much older fellow because it resonates, and it has for as long as I've been doing this, that this is the guy. So I'm really thrilled that we can talk to Mikko.
I'm not that young, Leo. I'm actually, I realized this in I think May or April. I was in California. I was lecturing at the Stanford University. And in Stanford, they have this big building called Gates Building, which is built by the money donated by Bill Gates. And in the lobby of the building, they have this plaque on the wall to commemorate the birth of the internet or the birth of ARPANET and the TCP/IP protocols and the Stanford professors who were working on it. And they've dated that birth date of ARPANET to late October 1969.
That's your birthday. That's
well, my birthday is tomorrow, so 13th of October 1969.
You're a little older. That is awesome. The same age as the ARPANET. It's fun. Yeah, I guess, you know, again, it sounds like, it feels like that's been around for as long as we can remember. And yet, that's not that 45, 46 years. That's not that long.
Yeah. That's and of course, the thing that really changed the internet, of course, is the web. And the web is only 25 years old.
That's right. We're going to talk more with Mikko in just a bit. I want to take a break. It's snack time. We like to start the show with snacks. And, of course, if it's snack time, it must be Nature Box time. Nature Box makes the best tasty snacks that are shipped right to your door. Not in Finland, I'm sorry. But you'll wish, when you hear about these, you'll wish you could. Nutritionist approved, whole wheat chocolate chip cookie bites. Now, you could go, right about this time of day, you could go right back to the vending machine at the back of the office and get something maybe not so great for you, full of trans fats and high fructose corn syrup, or you can go to your Nature Box. We actually buy Nature Box, a bunch of them for the staff, because we want them to eat healthy. This is my favorite, the Big Island Pineapple Rings. What's the ingredients? Let's see on the back. Dried pineapple. No sulfites, no artificial flavors, no artificial colors, no high fructose corn syrup, no trans fats, ever in anything from Nature Box. You got to love that. They come in savory, sweet, and spicy. You get to choose. You want some spicy? How about sriracha cashew crunch? Spicy clusters of cashew and rice with Peruvian corn. This is addictively good, so I'm not going to open it. They always come in a resealable bag, so you don't have to eat it all in one gulp. Don't. But you will. You know what? You'll feel really good that you've got your Nature Box. And you'll never be bored. Brand new snacks come out every month. There are more than 100 already. Everything. Oh, sweet kettle crunch, kettle peanuts with popcorn kernels.
You're making me hungry.
I told you, Mikko, you'd want this. This is so awesome. And they come every month. You pick what's in your box. You're going to love it. Your kids are going to love it. And there's a smart snack guarantee. So you could take a chance. Because, for instance, you know, when I first saw sriracha cashew crunch, I thought, I don't know. Take a chance. Because if you say, I didn't really like it, they'll replace it next box. I have to say, though, I'm glad I ordered these because, like I said, addictive, really, really good. Go online, get your first box right now. NatureBox.com/twit. NATURE, Nature, BOX, box.com/twit. Unbox a world of taste and possibility. And remember the smart snack guarantee. Takes the risks out of snacking. One wouldn't want risky snacking. We're talking to Mikko Hipponen. I know I'm mangling your name, but I'm doing the best I can. He is the Finnish antivirus researcher, security expert guru at F-Secure. And it, you know, you've spent, are you bored yet? I mean, you spent 25 years doing this. Is this like you figure I'm going to become a gardener.
Or I could go back to doing what I used to do before I started doing antivirus research.
Databases.
Well, yeah. Before that, I was driving the forklift.
What?
Yep.
This is better than
and
that.
I was really, really good driving the forklift. And the best part about driving the forklift is that when you go home after the day, you don't think about your work at all.
Yeah.
You don't think about it at all.
Yeah.
You spend the whole weekend without thinking about your work. And that doesn't really apply when you're working in IT. I'm thinking about our work all the time. So,
yeah, that's true, isn't it? You go home and you work. You probably get calls in the middle of the night. We got a new one, Mikko. We got to get you in here. You're probably one of the few security gurus in the world that's been profiled in Vanity Fair magazine.
Mm-hmm.
That's because you're a stylish fella.
When they called me for that, I didn't even know the magazine. So it's not that big a deal here in Europe. But I quickly learned. I think our people from our U.S. office told me that, yes, you want to do that. If Vanity Fair calls you, you want to do it.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. So back in the old days, we had boot sector viruses. We had internet worms. There were maybe one new virus a week, maybe not even that often. How many new malware exploits are there every week nowadays? What is the magnitude of this?
Well, the systems that we run today at F-Secure receive, on average, something like 350,000 sample submissions every single day.
What?
So 350,000 every day, okay. 7 days a week.
There's got to be some duplication there, though, right? I mean,
no. No, that's unique files. 350,000 unique file submissions. That doesn't mean 350,000 new cases of malware. That's file submissions for us to analyze. And we do analyze every single one of every single day.
Holy
so it's a highly, highly, highly automated process, obviously, for obvious reasons. There's no way we can do it, or any antivirus vendor could do it any other way. The amount of new detections that we build every day based on those samples is typically around 10,000. So if you want a number of like how many new cases of malware every day, around 10,000, 20 on a bad day.
And are they all Windows, or are we starting to see? I thought when mobile phones came out, they would be such a prime ground for malware authors because they're always connected. There's all sorts of ways you can make money on these things. And yet we haven't seen a real avalanche of exploits on mobile. Why is that?
Because Android and iOS, the two most prominent mobile operating systems, are very, very restrictive. I mean, think about the basics. Let's say you have an iPad. If you're a programmer, you can program your computer and you can give your program to anyone else who has a similar computer and they can run it as well. Well, if you are a programmer, you cannot program your iPad. The only way you can run your own programs on your iPad is by sending them to Apple to be approved. And then if Apple approves them, then you can run them and give them to your friends. So it's very, very restrictive. But at the very same time, it's also clearly more secure. So iOS is still very, very much clear of malware. We have very few cases of actual malware found on it. And there's a little bit more on jailbroken iPhones, but even that's very rare. There's a little bit more on Android. It's actually the second most common malware submission as a platform that we get to our systems is Android. Most of the samples we get is Windows, and the second most common platform is Android. Then OS X, and then the rest of them.
Interesting. Well, that's a little misleading because it's probably like 90% Windows, right? I mean,
it's 99.
Yeah. So it's second, but it's 1%. It's not yeah.
That's right.
Some of this, of course, is because we learn. We computer manufacturers, software companies, OS companies learned. When Windows was written, even when OS X was written, malware was not as prevalent. And of course, they were a little more open. I think we learned when it came time to write these mobile OSs that security had to come first, right?
That's right. And I think they also learned from platforms that you wouldn't think about. When you think about the model of iOS or Android, it's not that far from the model of PlayStation or Xbox. You can't program your PlayStation or your Xbox either.
They're closed.
They're very close, but they're very useful. And we all know that. I mean, right. You still get a great experience. You just can't do everything you want on those systems, but you can do the things you want to do in most cases. It's also a little bit sad in the sense that when you have these closed environments, it's sort of like converting the users from producers to consumers.
I agree.
It's a trade-off. And from security point of view, it's a good trade-off. You get much better security on these restrictive environments.
Now, of course, Linux is open. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't sound like you get a lot of Linux malware. Is that just because nobody's running it?
Well,
that's kind Android. Of a common that's a common argument. Is OS X safer because it's better written, or is it safer because who cares? Nobody wants to target it when 180 million machines are running Windows.
I disagree on the popularity of Linux, because Android is a Linux distribution.
Yes, I understand. But I mean, like Ubuntu kind, desktop Linux. Yeah.
Desktop Linux, which is, of course, a different story. The main reason why we aren't seeing more malware on OS X or Linux-based distributions is just two reasons. Number one, it's the market shares. Number two, the existing attackers have existing know-how with Windows.
They have Windows machines.
They've been doing that for so long. They know how it works.
Yeah.
Why? If you put yourself in the shoes of the, organized online criminal, you make your money by writing banking trojans or ransom trojans or Bitcoin mining botnets. Why would you invest your time and money targeting another platform which you are not familiar with if you have a great ongoing business with your current strategy? I mean, you're mostly running Windows malware. You have a huge low-hanging fruit, and it works. Why would you target any other platform?
You don't need to. Mm-hmm. So this is a kind of security through, not exactly obscurity, security through market share.
Security through market share. Well, if you think about, like, let's say Windows XP, which is a really sad story in computer security history, like how horrible it was when it was shipped from the security point of view. If you remember, Windows XP was completely connected to the internet by default, but it had no firewall.
Right.
All your ports were exposed by default, which was a bad idea. It had no automatic updates. When you had security vulnerabilities in your operating system, the way you patched yourself is that you took your Internet Explorer 4 and you surfed to Microsoft.com and you downloaded an EXE manually and then you ran it. I mean, that's how you patched
it.
Horrible. And then when you look at what it really meant, is it meant that Windows XP, despite all of these security shortcomings, it was a massive commercial success. Windows XP made billions and billions to Microsoft.
Right.
So security failures don't seem to affect your capability of sending or selling the actual operating system. And when you look at Windows XP and its competitors at the time, like Linux-based operating systems or Mac at the time, clearly Windows XP was inferior, but it was the leader in market space. And when we look at the mobile operating systems today, you could actually argue that Android is today's Windows XP.
Yeah.
It is the market leader. And when you compare it to the security models of Windows Phone or iOS, it's clearly the inferior because of it has more openness and, the track record isn't very good. So, again, think that the inferior security would somehow affect their sales, but it doesn't. Android is the clear market leader.
I think, though, since Windows XP, people have become more aware. Certainly, even Microsoft became more aware. By Service Pack 2, the firewall was turned on by default in Windows XP. Mm-hmm. And we've often said that was a watershed moment. That was the first time we started to gain on malware, just simply turning on an inbound firewall by default.
Yep. So that's really, it is really a watershed moment. I mean, Microsoft had no other choice than to start really putting security first. That was in 2003. We had Blaster and Slammer and Sassa Worms, all of these things going around the net, which was now very common. Everybody was online, but you had all these Windows XP machines with no firewall, and they were just searching for open ports, like, RPC port or LSASS port, and they would just infect your system while you were sleeping.
Over the internet. No action on your part. Just sitting there.
Which means Microsoft really had to do something because of these massive problems. Like, the customers were screaming. And what they did is that they totally turned around. They started implementing trustworthy computing. They implemented SP2 with built-in firewalls, with built-in automatic updates. Windows updates were created because of these problems.
Yeah.
And today, if you take, let's say, 64-bit Windows 10 and look at the security models built in and all the mitigations built in, it's very, very good. I mean, Microsoft is like a poster boy on how to turn yourself around in security in the way of like improving your security.
They've done some interesting things. If you upgrade for free to Windows 10 for 7 or 8, you're required to take the updates, which is, of course, good internet health, good public mm-hmm. policy. So good. I think this is a question a lot of people would like to know, especially people who are trying to decide. They're on the fence whether I should upgrade to Windows 10. Is Windows 10 more secure than Windows 8 and Windows 7?
Windows 10 is more secure. From a security point of view, it's a no-brainer. You should do it. However, from privacy point of view, it might not be a no-brainer.
Well, we know about that. Yeah. And that's something you cover too, privacy as well as security, right?
Well, I do think that those are the two most important problems for us to solve. The problem of security and the problem of privacy. And they are different problems, and there are no easy solutions for either one of them.
Yeah, the motto for F-Secure is switch on freedom. Mm-hmm. And that sounds to me like you think that governments are perhaps invading our privacy a little bit as well. Who's a bigger threat, private industry or government, when it comes to privacy?
Well, the most common threat for the everyday user is our privacy getting eroded by companies. Companies that we all love. Companies like Google and Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn. All these services that are making billions in profit by, you know, turning us into profiles and selling us to advertisers, which is the business model for all these large companies. So the most common privacy violations we run into are actually done by companies. But then we have a totally different problem, which is governmental surveillance. And that's, you know, something which affects everybody when we think about the kind of surveillance where people's data is being collected just for future purposes. We are the first generation whose communication can be collected and stored from the technical point of view basically forever. And this could be something which affects perfectly normal people whose data could be collected and saved just for the purpose that those people might turn out to be someone important or someone interesting 10 years from now or 20 years from now. And that's a really scary thought. And this has never before in mankind's history been possible. Now it is, for the first time, possible.
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, of course, everybody has the right to privacy. And I know especially in Europe, the EU is very concerned about this and seems to be implementing much stronger privacy protections for European citizens than here in the States. But it does seem to me that somebody like Google selling your information to advertisers is a much less of a threat than a government that has tanks and missiles collecting information on you. A government can harm you in so many more ways than an advertiser. And don't get me wrong, and I know people get mad at me for saying this, like, well, we have the right to protect ourselves against advertisers. Of course you do. But the threat posed by Google seems to me completely on a different scale than the threat posed by a government.
It's a different thing, and it's hard to even compare them. But I think the eye-opener I often recommend to people works very well, and that is go to these free services like Google or Facebook or Twitter, and for once, go there not as the user, go there as a customer. So go there, take out your credit card, spend $5, and buy an ad. It will open up your eyes when you see for yourself.
What you can know,
Facebook lets you pinpoint your ad like on location, on name, on gender, on interest, and you wouldn't believe how well they know what we're interested in. And then when you go through the actual wizard, the ad creation wizard, and then the end, it will tell you that, okay, thank you for this profile of the person you would like to show your ads to. There are 341 people like that, and we will show your ad to them tomorrow. And it's quite remarkable.
And of course, another cause for concern is the very apparently porous barrier between companies like Google and Microsoft and the governments. That there seems to be a free flow of information between the two. So it may be the case that it's not just advertisers that these companies end up collecting information for. Unwillingly, perhaps, nevertheless, thanks to the Patriot Act in the United States, they're forced to give that information up to at least the U.S. government.
And that's one of the big problems we have when we look at the situation with the global view. The fact is that, for example, here in Europe, we all use US-based services. I mean, there's very, very few success stories, IT success stories from Europe. I mean, by far the largest IT company in Europe is SAP from Germany. Right. And it's 10 times larger than number two. when we do have the rare success stories, like Skype out of Estonia,
right?
Well, that was sold to Microsoft very quickly, and so on. And the problem is, when you look at the U.S. laws, you do actually have privacy regulations, but they give no privacy rights to foreigners like me.
Right.
And almost all of the rest of the world uses U.S. services, and only 95% of the planet, 95% of the planet are foreigners. So you give no rights to us, the 95% of the planet, yet we keep using your services because there's very little competition. And it's a little bit surprising to me that Europe has been unable to really build success stories on the web, considering that the web was, after all, invented here in Europe.
Well, that may be changing because, as you know, the European Court of Justice has just recently ruled that U.S. Companies have to adhere to European privacy laws, which is causing a few people in the United States to freak out because, of course, that's a very, very different matter than adhering only to the United States privacy laws.
Mm-hmm. I think that decision will make especially a lot of lawyers really happy.
Yeah.
That's basically what it's going to do.
It's going to be a mess. This is so great. I wish we had 5 hours to talk to you. We're talking to Mikko Hipponen. He is the chief research officer for one of the premier security companies in the world for 25 years, F-Secure. And when you read F-Secure's mission statement, I think you'll understand kind of what this is all about. In the digital world, they write, it seems like everyone wants a piece of you. Hackers, internet trackers, online spies. We believe you should have the freedom to live your digital life without worry. I love this because it's really gone beyond just we want to lock your computer down so the bad guys don't get in. It's our passion for freedom that pushes us to create better products and services to enable and empower you. I really like that mission statement. And I've been a fan of F-Secure since, as I said, 1991. But I'm even more of a fan now because I think you're fighting. This is a very important fight. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to ask you who – we mentioned big internet companies. We've mentioned governments. But who's making all this malware? and what are they up to? And this is a kind of changes all the time, you know, what they're trying to do on your machine. It's gone a long way from, you know, just painting a picture on your screen and saying, ha ha, we got you. What are they up to? We'll talk about that next when we continue with Mikko Hipponen. Our show today brought to you by Blue Apron. Our Blue Apron box came the other day. It made me so happy. I love my Blue Apron box. This is a really great service for people who like to cook or want to learn to cook, but like you and me are busy. And, you know, we get to the end of the day and the last thing we want to do is go to the market. Europeans have it right because they market every day, always have fresh ingredients. They spend some time cooking. It's a social experience. Here in the States, you know, we're so busy. We get home. That's why fast food is through the roof. That's why people are using their microwave ovens like crazy. Blue Apron wants to take us back to a day where you would have lovely, fresh ingredients. You don't have to buy them. They come to your door, never frozen, always fresh in a refrigerated box. And then they come with these incredible recipes. And half an hour later, maybe 45 minutes if you're like me and a slow worker, you get an amazing meal for you, for your loved ones, for your family, for less than 10 bucks a meal. Blue Apron, it's incredible. Try Southern-style burgers with green tomato chow chow and Old Bay oven fries. That's one meal. Mixed mushroom risotto with porcini broth, leek, and chives. What are you going to make there, tilapia? That looks fantastic. So every week, a different menu plan. You see, there's a two-person plan and a family plan. The family plan has more kid-friendly ingredients. And, by the way, what a great thing to do this with your kids. Because I'll tell you, if there's one skill I wish my kids had, it's how to cook a meal for themselves. You can't go into life without knowing how to do this. Otherwise, you're going to be living at Denny's. That's no good. I want you to go to blueapron.com. You can try it right now. Get your first two meals free. You'll be blown away by the quality, the freshness, and by the confidence it gives you the next time to make this meal on your own. There's never a repeat. You always have new recipes to try. I've learned so many great techniques. They have videos on the website if you have questions. I've learned so much about cooking just by getting a Blue Apron box. And it's fun. Perfect for date night, for cooking with friends, or getting the whole family together for a meal where you all sit down and you talk to each other. And the kids love it that they helped cook it. BlueApron.com/twit. They have vegetarian menus as well. So, they can cater it to just exactly your dietary needs, but you're going to get wonderful stuff. Look, this is this week's Southern-style burgers with green tomato, chow chow, and Old Bay. The seared chicken and autumn vegetables with apple cider mustard jus. One-pot shrimp purlieu. Now, I've never heard of purlieu, but I bet you it's good, and it sure looks good. That sounds... You learn so much. Purlieu comes from the Carolinas and the Georgias, the coastal areas. It's a rice dish. I'm reading the recipe guide. That looks so good. Are you ready?
You're making me hungry again.
Again, I know, Mika. We're all about making you hungry and making you a better cook. BlueApron.com/Twit. Get your first two meals absolutely free. I'm sorry, Miko. You have to suffer through that. I have to suffer through that, too.
And it's past my dinner time. It's getting close to 10 p.m.
I'm sorry. Miko Happonen is with us, Chief Research Officer at F-Secure. Started disassembling viruses in the early 90s, figuring out what they were doing. In those days, I mean, the guys who wrote Brain, what was their motivation? It was like a, ha-ha, gotcha.
Actually, the two guys behind Brain, when I asked them this question, they explained to me that they were they had a programming background of mainframes, of Unix-based systems, and some large mainframe IBM systems, or AIX, I believe. And when they saw these new PC systems running PC-DOS and MS-DOS, they were horrified that they had no security model whatsoever.
Oh, ever.
And they just wanted to prove that that's a big problem and there should be something done about it. And they, I guess they did prove that it's a problem by writing the brain worm or the brain virus, which then went around the world infecting computers in dozens of different countries.
Is that still the kind of thing that when you find out who wrote malware, is that still... You mentioned, for instance, you can buy a kit now. Mm-hmm. There are quite a few kits actually out there, and they're how much does it cost? Let's say I'm a bad guy. First of all, what's my motivation?
The vast majority of online criminals do their attacks to make money. Money is by far the biggest motivation. It's not the only one. Of course, we have hacktivist gangs who want to protest.
Yeah,
exactly. Or we have the governmental actors, and now we are more worried about extremists, especially Islamic State, because they do have some skills as well.
Interesting.
But by far the largest attacker group are online criminals who are trying to make money one way or another. And one of the most common ways, like we discussed, is by using exploit kits. And they aren't expensive at all. I mean, you could pay maybe a Bitcoin and a half, so $200-$400 for a kit, which gets you started. Then you just have to hack a website and drop it there and wait for new victims to come in.
How many exploits are in that kit?
It could be dozens of different exploits. Most of those are getting old, though, so they don't really come shipped with brand new zero-day exploits because those are very valuable. But it doesn't really matter because there are so many out-of-date computers online surfing the web that you will get plenty of victims just by having a basic exploit kit running on a site if the site just has lots of visitors.
And this is how we get infected now. It's a moving target. It used to be a boot disk, then it was email. In an attachment, for years I said, don't open attachments. Still, attachments are still a problem, right? Especially with spear phishing.
That's number two.
That's how we think Sony Pictures Entertainment got hacked, with targeted emails to Sony employees. But now you go to a website, it's in PHP. This has happened to us. It's Drupal. They've got a module on there that's a known flaw. You use the flaw, you get access to the drive, and you put an exploit kit on there. People are still going to the site because the site isn't a malicious site. It's a normal site, like our site. This happened about four years ago.
So it actually happened to you guys? I didn't know
about
this.
4 years ago, yeah. We had an open directory. Somebody put not a whole kit. It was a very simple PHP exploit on there. And the good news is Google flagged us almost immediately.
Okay.
How did that happen?
Well, Google indexes the sites over and over again to search for, to create new content to search for, and especially for a site like yours, which keeps on changing every day because you have new content every day. They might come over every 15 minutes, and they, when they look at your content, if they find references to sites that they know are used for malware distribution, they know that you've been hacked with an exploit kit, and they will automatically stop all traffic through the Google search engine to your site or through the Chrome browser. To your site.
Right. And we've all seen that. This site has malware. Enter at your own risk. And, of course, as soon as we saw that and we heard reports and we saw that on our site, we immediately did a security. This is not an easy thing to do. The security assay to figure out what the flaw was. We found the flaw right away. We fixed the module. We removed the flaw. We immediately notified all of our users. The good news, it was, as you said, a very old exploit that very few people would be vulnerable to. You'd have to have a very old version of Java, I think it was. And that's not unusual. These exploit kits aren't, as you say, the best zero-day stuff. Yeah. They're old stuff, but it works with enough people. But, okay, so it works. What happens? I go to this site. I don't know anything about computers. I have a Windows XP machine. Hasn't been patched in years. I go, let me go surf to this site. And I don't have a virus warning because I'm using Internet Explorer 6. And I get infected. Now what?
Then it depends. Then they will drop what they call a payload. And the payload will try to make money one way or another. They have to make money because they just paid money for the exploit kit and they have to get the money back. So it might be dropping a keylogger. Keylogger, which starts collecting whatever you type on the keyboard. So they get your passwords, they get your PayPal and eBay password, they get your credit card information the next time you buy something online. Or they might drop a banking trojan, which will sit on your computer until you go to do online banking, and then it will, on the fly, change the account numbers. You will be sending your money to the wrong place. Or it might be one of these ransom trojans, which have been a major headache over the last 2 years, which will go through your, not only your computer, but also through your network and encrypt all the files it can find and then ask you to pay money to get your file, to get your own files back.
Like CryptoLocker.
Mm-hmm. CryptoLocker and CryptoWall would be two very prominent examples of this.
Yeah. How common is a keylogger? That seems like a lot of work for the bad guy. He's got to go back to the machines and collect the information and then use it against people. Is that a very common exploit?
It actually is a very typical thing, but the keyloggers are actually throwing away almost everything they keylog, and very many of them only collect the credit card data. So they're waiting for you to type in the patterns of credit card data, you know, the right amount of numbers. So that's the credit card date, the credit card number, credit card expiration date, credit card CVC code. They only look for that because that's easily turned into money. That's easily resellable in the online. In many of these cases, when they collect valuable information, they don't actually misuse it themselves. They go back to the same forums where they bought the exploit kit, and then they will sell that, okay, now I have 6,000 credit card numbers. Anybody willing to buy these? And then somebody buys off them. And these are sort of like buy and sell forums, which are running in the Tor hidden service through which these guys get the tools, get the training, and on which they actually then sell the goods they stole from the end users.
And who are these people? Is it the mafia? Is it organized crime? Or is it just some kid in Bulgaria who has a lot of free time? I mean, who is this that's doing this?
Well, it is organized crime, but it's not the same organized crime that is running like real-world organized crime, like drug trafficking or mafia. It's new kind of organized online crime where these people who are working together in these scams really have gangs, but they might have never met each other. They might not know each other's real names at all. And many of them are coming from countries which are in one way or another sort of developing countries. So guys who have know-how, who have the skills, who have training, but who don't have a job.
I often mention Eastern Europe because that's one of the areas where there are a lot of great technical schools, a lot of very skilled programmers who are underemployed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I live in Eastern Europe. I live in goddamn Finland, right next to Russia.
Is Russia the number one source of this problem?
Russia is number one. And, of course, there's a big... The border between Finland and Russia is 1,500 kilometers long, and there's a big difference in the between these two countries. I mean, in Finland, if you have know-how, if you're a programmer, if you understand protocols, you can easily get a job with your skills. But if you have exactly the same skills and you live somewhere in, I don't know, Siberia, it's going to be much harder for you to do that. Yeah. And when we look at the bigger picture, there's a clear trend that many, many of these online criminals that we track come from ex-Soviet states.
Yep.
So if not from Russia itself, then from Ukraine, from Belarus, or from Eastern Europe countries like, you know, Romania, or growing amount of them are coming from Far East Asia, like Vietnam is growing. Mm-hmm. Also, countries in Africa are growing, not just in Nigerian scams, but actually real malware cases as well.
Interesting. Did they get rich?
Some of them do. There's actually a court case against one guy from Estonia that's going to go to court on Thursday. And he made something between $10 and $20 million with the, that operation. He actually had 10, 12, 13 guys working for him for the operation. So
it was a business.
Yeah, it's a business. If you do it right, it's definitely a business.
And the crypto wall has made a lot of people a lot of money, I think.
Crypto Locker and Crypto Wall and many of the copycats have made a lot of money. And there's actually quite a bit of competition among these ransom Trojan gangs. There's a bunch of these gangs operating from St. Petersburg in Russia, a bunch of them operating from Moscow in Russia. And the thing that really made all of this possible was the combination that they figured out how to do crypto right. So the encryption algorithms they use to encrypt your files are irreversible without the key. So there's no way for you, the victim, to get your files back. And the number two thing which made it possible is cryptocurrencies or virtual currencies or Bitcoin, because that's how they always ask for the ransom to be sent.
Yeah, you need some anonymous form of payment. Otherwise, you're not going to use your credit card. You could be quite easily tracked.
Right.
What about botnets? Right. Are we still seeing botnets? Is that still prevalent?
Oh, yeah. It's quite typical that when you have these keyloggers or banking Trojans, they're actually connected to each other. That's how the criminal controls these infected machines. So it becomes a network of infected machines or network of bots or a botnet. Botnets can, of course, be used for many other purposes as well. And it's quite typical that these guys will run, for example, a banking Trojan operation on their botnet. And when they've done that and they have no further use for them themselves, they will sell the botnet to someone else. And they will get more money, or they will be able to get money twice out of the same infected machines. And whoever buys those machines might be using the same machines for something else, for example, for launching distributed denial of service attacks against websites and then ask for money to stop the attacks. 2 or 3 years ago, we saw a lot of scams, or a lot of botnets which were actually making money by doing Bitcoin mining. So before Bitcoin mining difficulty became too hard to do on normal PC hardware, they would actually try to infect high-end PCs, especially gaming PCs, which had high-end NVIDIA and ATI graphic cards, which they could actually use to do mining. And that's a really interesting attack, because in that case, they are not stealing anything from the victim. The victim loses no money. The victim only uses CPU cycles. But it was still profitable for the attackers.
How well coded are most of these? You know, I think it used to be with, in fact, one of the reasons the Morris worm got loose is because it wasn't that well written, and it exploded. How well written are modern day viruses? Are they pretty sophisticated?
Most of them are crap.
Okay. That was my sense of it, but I just was checking.
that's exactly what it is. I mean,
they're
most
hacks.
Of these really but then there are the exceptions. And I guess the most glaring exceptions are the cases of governmental malware that we've been analyzing over the last 10 years.
Flame.
Some of that stuff. Well, yeah. Flame is a great example. Stuxnet is another great example. Some of the members of the Duke family, which we believe is coming from Russian government, is a great example. The Duku worm, which is believed to be the work of Israel, is also a great example of something which obviously took a lot of money, a lot of manpower, a lot of cutting-edge research. And it just shows that when you change from looking at the code created by just criminal gangs coming out of Ukraine and compare to the level of difficulty of programs written by governmental attackers, it's like night and day.
Yeah, some of these governmental worms, they're so obviously written by a state agency because they're so sophisticated and they do so many... Flame did so many interesting things to cover its tracks.
Mm-hmm, that's right. Flame was able to repurpose a Microsoft certificate, so the code shipped by Flame was actually, it looked like it was signed by Microsoft, when in fact it wasn't. And to do that is, you know, almost impossible. But they did it anyway.
What about China? What is the threat that China poses to the West? And are these hackers or the governmental agencies? It seems like the threats from China are growing, aren't they?
Yep, China is definitely on our radar more and more in many ways. I mean, for example, most of the mobile malware that we see is actually a problem only within China. And one of the reasons for that is that the Great Firewall, on and off, over and over again, restricts access to places like Google Play or the Apple App Store, which means people who are running Android devices or iOS devices inside China are installing apps from other sources, side loading. So that's one of the reasons why we see lots of mobile malware problems in China.
Very clever hack to modify Xcode, the development platform, so that it would work perfectly well, but just as a little added benefit, add to your code malware.
There you go.
And then you get on the App Store. And by the way, it leaked into some of the most popular apps in China, like WeChat.
Mm-hmm. Which is really weird. You would think that developers of popular programs like that would get the programming environment from the right source. But as we learned, they didn't. They just got it from some random site within China. Maybe it was faster download or something. Right. But you know, nevertheless, it happened. Then we have Chinese criminals just targeting victims all over the world, trying to make money with the same mechanisms as any other criminals. But especially the governmental action from China has been interesting to watch. In fact, the very first governmental malware case that we ever analyzed, in this very lab where I'm sitting right now here in Helsinki, that happened in 2003, so 12 years ago. And that attack was clearly from the Chinese government, targeting defense contractors here in Europe. And the attack back then in 2003 was actually very, very similar to the kind of attacks we still see today in 2015. It was an email sent to key employees within the target company, which was spoofed. So the email looked like it was coming from a trusted sender, someone they knew and trust. And it contained an email body in the local language and an attachment, which was a document file. So it seemed trustworthy to click on. And when you actually clicked on the document, you got a document on your screen, which looked like a normal file, except it had already exploited your system with an exploit which was embedded in the document file. Wow. And the backdoor it dropped on your system was completely invisible, but it gave the outsiders, in this case the Chinese, full access to everything on your computer, plus access to everything you could access in your organization's local area network.
One of the newer concerns, and actually some of the concern comes from the Snowden revelations about what the NSA has been up to for years, is hardware hacking, hardware malware. There's bad USB, but since almost everything we use these days in the West is made in China, should we be concerned about malware embedded in our hardware?
Well, It's problematic. I mean, it's one of those nightmare scenarios that you wish wouldn't really happen. But we don't have very many cases where that could have actually been proven, that they would have embedded hardware Trojans on purpose. And it's also interesting to think about that, where are our CPUs coming from? I mean, you're right. Almost all the electronics being built in the world are being built in China. But the CPUs are still very much controlled by U.S. companies, by Intel and AMD. And the level of complexity in the microcode of a typical CPU nowadays has gone through the roof already a decade ago. There's no way for any outsider to figure out what these chips are really doing behind the surface or beneath the surface. And it's interesting that Intel and AMD, while they have outsourced lots of their other manufacturing plants, all the chip fabrication plants are physically inside USA regarding CPU manufacturing. So,
although Intel is building fabs in China, I understand. Mm. However, I think you make an excellent point. The complexity of hacking that is such a high bar that it's so much easier just to hack the firmware on a driver card or a hard drive card or a router would be an excellent place to embed some malicious code, and not so hard to do, right? I want to take a break. When we come back, you mentioned zero-day exploits. I want to talk about the rise of zero-day exploits and whether there's even any reason to run an antivirus anymore in light of that. We're talking to Mikko Heponen. He is the chief research officer of one of the premier security companies, one of the companies I've trusted for 25 years, F-Secure. They're doing great work to protect our digital privacy and to protect our security online. And we'll have more in just a little bit, but I want to tell you where I get my medication. There's a segue. PillPack, of course. PillPack is a brilliant idea, full-service pharmacy that combines, you know, a real pharmacy with a real pharmacist on call 24/7, by the way, so you can get the answers to your questions. But then they deliver your medication in a unique and incredible way. In a box, this solves a really big problem. Have you ever gone through the issue of, did I take my morning pills? Did I take my evening pills? Of course, as you get older or you develop a medical condition, your prescription medication becomes even more vital that you do it at the right time. This is my new pill pack. I'm going to tear off the top here. Actually, let me just tear off a pill pack. Every day, it tells you what time, what day, tells you what date, exactly what's in your pill pack. There's never any question, did I take my 8 a.m. pills? Because, yeah, they're gone. You took them. All your prescription meds, all your supplements, all your over-the-counters can come through PillPack. It's an online pharmacy. They're using incredibly sophisticated robotic technology and digital imaging technology. So they know exactly what's in your pack. And then, of course, a pharmacist double-checks it. So every PillPack is accurate, which is something I have to say. You can't say if you're putting together your own little pills in a medication box. No extra cost beyond the standard copay. See, it's so cool. Beyond the standard copay for medications, shipping is free. There's really no reason not to do this. It's compatible with most major insurance plans, including most forms of Medicare Part D. It's very easy to switch. It'll take you 5 minutes on their secure site. They will call your physician proactively, make sure everything's all right. So transferring the prescription over is easy. One of Time Magazine's top 25 inventions for last year, Jill Duffy, you know Jill, she's on our shows all the time, gave it a great review on PC Magazine. There's even a medication reminder for the iPhone and the Apple Watch. Your watch will ding you when it's time to go to your pill pack. I love this idea, even if it's just for vitamins or over-the-counter medications. But when it starts to come to prescription medication time, I got to tell you, there's no better way to do this than pill pack. And you'll get your new pill pack every couple of weeks automatically. You don't have to renew anything. The convenience is amazing, and not at any additional cost. So visit pillpack.com/twit. Sign up now. When you use that link and you transfer your prescriptions over, we're going to give you a credit worth $20 for vitamins or over-the-counter medication. Pilp, check this out. And you know what? If you've got family members who are on medication, this is what you should do. pillpack.com/twit, especially if you're elders, your parents. It's always a challenge. Did you take your meds, Mom? This is a fantastic solution. Do this for your family. Yeah, maybe for yourself. pillpack.com/twit. We are having such a good time talking to Mikko Hopponen. He is the chief research officer at F-Secure. For 25 years, he's been on the front line. You're in the labs right now. What do you do to keep those computers isolated so that viruses don't spread? When we wanted to play with a virus on the old Screensaver show, we actually took a computer, we painted it red so no one would ever use it. We said, do not touch. We disconnected it from the network, and then we infected it with a malware so we could look at something like CryptoWall, whatever it was, how it worked. You must do something like that. This is like a medical facility, right?
Yeah, it's a secure facility. It's isolated physically from the rest of the company. The analysts who are here working with malware samples run three different networks. We have like green network, orange network, and a red network. And you can tell which network you're on because of the physical cables are green, orange, or red. And red, of course, is the network full of malware. Orange is something that's not supposed to contain malware, but for security purposes, it's isolated from the public net. So you could actually use it, for example, to move malware samples from one location to another. And green is the normal office network that you would use to check your email. Then we also have Faraday cages, like completely isolated rooms where we can safely try wireless traffic or malicious traffic or mobile traffic without fearing that it would actually escape our facilities. We actually have, we call these RF labs. And we have one RF lab here in Helsinki, one in our labs in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur. And the best use for these RF labs is that, well, once you're in there, of course, your phone won't work because you're in a Faraday cage. And we also have clear rules that once you're in there and the door is closed, no one else is allowed to open the door, because then if there's a test underway, you know, malicious traffic might escape. So if you want to go and have a nap, the best way to have it, place to have a nap is right there. Nobody's going to open the door. Nobody can ring you. So. Don't tell anybody, Leo.
So this is all feels like it's exploding, and there's new exploits. As you mentioned, you've got 10,000 unique exploits every day that are showing up in your lab. You still create an antivirus program, right? Or an anti-malware program? Is that correct? Mm-hmm.
That's correct.
Does it use signatures? What do you use these days to be effective? I mean, you'd have to 10,000 new viruses every day. You'd have to be updating every 5 minutes.
Well, it's based nowadays more and more on cloud solutions, which basically means that we have a light client running on the end user computer or an end user phone, which is trying to detect something which is known and trusted, or something which is unknown. And if it's unknown, it sends, calculates a hash of the file and then queries our cloud whether it's okay to run this file or not okay to run this file, which means you don't have to be downloading signature updates every 5 minutes. We can just, the system can just query it from our end, which means most of the work is done on our end, so it won't slow down your computer or your phone.
Now that Windows 10 comes with an antivirus, an anti-malware program, they've really locked things down. OS 10, same thing. In fact, in the new OS 10 El Capitan, they've actually got a kernel security module that's it's breaking a lot of software, but it makes it even more secure. Do we even need to run antivirus software anymore?
Yes, you still need it, but it's not going to be enough by itself. I mean, security has to be layered. You have several layers of defenses to really secure your systems. Antivirus is not going to fix everything, but it clearly helps because the majority of the problems you're running into aren't actually that complicated, and antivirus will help deal with the majority of the problems. You still need patching solutions. You need intrusion prevention systems or IDS systems. You need multiple levels of firewalls, but it really is a layered defense that you want to build if you want to be secure in your network.
Well, given the prevalence of zero-day exploits, it seems like it would be very hard to keep up these things. But that was what Melissa really told us was, my God, if this spreads via email, a virus can be released in the wild and spread globally almost instantaneously. And it's even worse now. And zero-day exploits, there's no way you could fight a zero-day exploit, is there?
There is. There are generic exploit detection mechanisms which don't need any particular information about the exploit in itself. And they might be, for example, we have these built into our systems. They will be able to block whole classes of exploits without knowing any particulars. And we can actually run systems which will protect specific applications, like extra protection for Adobe Reader, extra protection for Microsoft Word, trying to detect whether they get exploited.
Got it.
And there's plenty of things you could do. For example, if, let's say, Adobe Reader, the process of Adobe Reader writes a new file on the hard drive, and that file is an executable. Well, that really shouldn't be happening. There's no normal situation where Adobe Reader would create a new file, which is actually an .exe file. And we will actually detect that and block that. And that's a very generic protection. We don't need to know how it got exploited. We don't need to know what it wrote on the hard drive. We just know that this is unusual. This shouldn't be happening. And it will automatically be blocked.
Yeah. How about on mobile devices? Most mobile devices don't have antiviruses. There are all the antivirus software companies offer mobile protection. Do we really need it? I know I'm asking somebody who makes this software, so.
Right. Yeah. Please buy our cheap antivirus today.
But now, I trust you, Mikko. I know you're not going to steer me wrong.
Yeah. Well, it's a little bit different on mobile platforms because on mobile systems, the antivirus is just another app. We have no special rights. We can't actually, you know, clean other files out of infections, just like any other apps can't access other applications either. It's a much more restrictive environment. The most typical problems that you actually run into on mobile devices aren't secure problems. The most typical problems are privacy problems, and there are very good fixes for privacy problems on mobile devices. In fact, our fastest growing product right now is our mobile hybrid VPN solutions, which is technically a VPN that you run on your iPad or on your Android device on your phone. But it means that all of your traffic, regardless of whether it's over the mobile phone or mobile communication or over Wi-Fi, gets encrypted on the device and rerouted through one of our data centers before it hits the real internet. And this gives you several benefits. We can remove tracking cookies or privacy violations, not just within your web traffic, but also within your app traffic. And everything gets encrypted. So if you're in Starbucks and somebody's running Wireshark in the same cafeteria, they won't see anything you're doing because everything is encrypted automatically by our VPN.
Is this the Freedom project?
That's the Freedom. And it's been growing very, very quickly. People really, you know, want some kind of a protection for their mobile devices, and this really gives it. And it's the easiest product to use I've ever seen. You have one button to turn it on and off.
But something like Stage Fright, and now there's a new version of Stage Fright, there's not much you can do because you don't have access to the level. You can't modify the Stage Fright library on Android. So all you could best you could do is detect it, right?
That's right. Yeah. And we could prevent it from getting you know, downloading any existing files, which would try to exploit the stage fright vulnerability.
Right.
But once it's on the system, there's nothing we could do because we are just another app.
Right.
But, you know, with a VPN-based solution, we can handle all the attacks that come, basically all the attacks that come from the web or come from over the internet. There's nothing we could do if you, like, plug in your iPad to your computer with, right, a, with a USB cable because we won't be able to see that traffic.
This freedom is a really interesting technology. I wasn't aware of this. I'm going to have to take a look. Essentially, I'm routing everything through F-Secure.
That's right. And you can even select which of our data centers you want to use. And that's kind of handy because let's say you're traveling in Europe, but you want to watch Netflix from your hotel room.
Right.
Well, you won't be able to watch the same movies in Europe because of the restrictions. With Freedom, you can change your location back to the United States and have exactly the same selection that you would at home.
Very interesting.
Or let's say you want to watch Top Gear from BBC, brand new shows, I mean, or something like that.
Right.
Well, you can actually move yourself to UK and watch iPlayer, and it actually works.
So it's kind of like a VPN in that respect.
It is a VPN, but it's a hybrid VPN, so we do much more than just encrypt your traffic. We also protect your privacy at the same time and provide security features as well.
Do you have to break HTTPS to do that? Do you have to use your own certificates and do, in effect, a man in the middle, or...?
No, we don't do man in the middle. We've actually had a discussion over that over and over again, but we've made the decision of not breaking the security of SSL or TSL on the device.
And I applaud that, but then, of course, that means that with a, if I have an SSL connection to a malicious site, I'm going to get the data because you can't see what I'm doing.
It's a trade-off. So far, we've decided not to do it.
I think it's the right thing. I'll be honest. I would be much more likely to use it if you don't break a SSL. Than if you do. Mm-hmm. So,
and we, if we change our mind on that, I'll let you know.
Okay, good. I'm actually very tempted. It's an affordable service. I'll have to check it out. Mm. So who's winning, the bad guys or the good guys?
It's a game of ongoing. It's a mouse and cat race. I mean, there's no way either of us is ever going to win. I mean, the core problem is that the bad guys have access to our weapons. So imagine yourself, you know, being a malware writer. You've just written a new piece of backdoor or Trojan or whatever. The first thing you're going to do is that you're going to download today's antiviruses and scan your latest malware to detect if they find it or not. And you know what? Most of them will probably find it in one way or another. But then, of course, you can modify it. You can just change the code and rescan it, repeat this process until it is undetectable, which means the bad guys always have an upper hand. They will always be able to create new malware, which is not detected by today's anti-malware products. And then, of course, we have to find the new sample very quickly and build detection for it. And it's a race. And the bad guys do have an upper hand. So it's sometimes a little bit frustrating.
You guys don't do a password vault, do you? Because I'm looking for a replacement for LastPass.
We actually do have a password manager as well. Yes, we do.
Uh-huh. Well, I have to say, I became a fan of F-Secure and have trusted it for 25 years because you gave away F-Disk, your antivirus. We were able to send it out for free to thousands of our radio show listeners in 1991 to fight Michelangelo. You still offer a free version of that, don't you?
Yeah, we do.
And
you're not really a free antivirus vendor like, you know, some of the others in the place. But, yeah, we do have plenty of tools that we give away for free.
F-Prod, is that still out there?
F-Prod, the old product, doesn't really exist as such. The company that we worked with together in the early days, which was a company out of Reykjavik. Frisk's company was sold to another company in Israel 2 years ago or something like that. Mm. So something along those lines.
But I certainly trust F-Secure. And I figure if you're doing it, you're not going to sell your company to log me in. I can continue to use your product for some time to come. Mikko,
it's been great to be here. And one of the things that have always been very important to us is that we try to sell our products the old-fashioned way. Like you pay for our product with money instead of paying with your privacy.
I like it. It is old-fashioned nowadays, but it makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, when you use a computer, it is an exercise in trust from the people who manufactured it to the firmware in it to the software you're running on it to the services you use online. It's an exercise in trust, but you have to figure out who you trust and who you don't trust.
The webcast you love from the people you trust.
I hope people trust me, and I know I trust you. So, Mikko, I thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Leo.
F-Secure, F-Secure.com. And Miko's a great guy to follow on Twitter, at M-I-K-K-O. I'm going to try it now. Mika Hippinen.
Not even close.
Not even. thank you so much for your time today. Great to talk to you. We do Triangulation every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC on Twit. Hope you'll tune in. Hope you'll be in the chat room because your questions are very, very valuable to me because then I know what to ask our guests. But if you can't watch live, please subscribe. We make on-demand audio and video available after the fact at twit.tv/TRI. There's a YouTube version you can subscribe to. There's podcast clients, and every one of them has Triangulation. Make sure you subscribe. Make sure you get it every week because I tell you, I guarantee you, your brain will expand every time. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.